Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the Health and Social Services Committee to order. It's 3 o'clock on January 21st, and President and Representative Tarr, Representative and Vice Chair Vasquez, Representative Wohl, myself, Chair Seaton. I want to remind everybody to turn their cell phones off, and since we're starting here again, please remember to direct questions through the chair. Today we will have two presentations, and the first one will be from the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council, and we have the Chair of the Council, Mr. William Martin, here, as well as the Executive Director of the Council, Kate Burkhart, to make the presentation, and if you would like to come forward, please do, and I want to have the record reflect that Representative Talrico is here with us as well. And good afternoon, and go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kate Burkhart, and I am the Executive Director of the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is William Martin. I am Chair of the Statewide Suicide Council, and on that council representing Alaska Federation of Native. This Statewide Suicide Council was formed 15 years ago by the legislature, and it consists of 13 volunteers who are full-fledged voting members, and four legislative members, two from the House and two from the Senate that are appointed by the Senate and House leadership. And we're fortunate to have Representative Tarr as a member of our council, and she's been very appreciative for all the work that she is doing for us.
One thing to note about, this is Kate Burkhart, and one thing to note for members of the committee is that the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has benefited from several members' leadership that have served for many years. In addition to Chairman Martin, who has served for more than 10 years?
12 years.
12 years. Megan Crow from the Lower Kuskokwim School District. Barb Franks representing survivors of a loss to suicide. We have institutional memory as well as the creativity and energy of newer members, which has really helped enhance the council's organizational capacity and performance over the last 5 years. We've also had the benefit of our Senate members, both of whom have served for 6 years, Senator McKinnon and Senator Gardner.
And before you proceed, I want to interrupt and recognize that Representative Stutz has joined us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This council is responsible for supporting the governor and giving advice to the governor on the tragedy of suicide in the state. Also with the legislature, we have the reports that we give every year in the communities that we serve throughout Alaska. We're here to improve health and wellness throughout the state, and by reducing suicide and its effects on individuals, families, and communities. We want to broaden Alaska's awareness of suicide and the role of risk and protective factors. In particular, we'd like to make sure that every Alaskan knows the signs of suicide. It'd be a big help for them to recognize people who are on the verge of doing harm to themselves. We want to enhance suicide prevention services and programs. We have various classes that we can give out instruction to. We like to present to corporations and agencies and do some sort of education in anywhere from half an hour to all day. And it's up to those entities to choose how much time we would give them. We want to develop healthy communities through comprehensive collaboration, community-based, health-based approaches, implementation at the community level, and support by regional, state, and federal resources. We develop and implement a strategic suicide prevention plan, and it is in the process of being updated and will be available to the legislature shortly. But the last one that we did is on our website, which is stopsuicidealaska.org, and it's there for anybody to see. We want to strengthen and existing and build new partnerships between public and private entities that will advance suicide prevention.
You see that these are very broad mandates for a very small council with limited resources. And so the council, through some very deliberate work about 5 years ago, decided that the best way to achieve these responsibilities was through coordination of effort, collaborating with partners both within and outside of state government, and ensuring effective communication. And so the next part of the presentation will be kind of an overview of how we coordinate, collaborate, and communicate.
And before you proceed, I wanted to interrupt and say that we've been joined by Representative Foster, so we have a full committee. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On here, you'll see our, a copy of our report, Casting the Net series. And this is what is available online and will be made available to you. In one of the pictures, it shows people, young people putting messages on a board. This is messages that they put down themselves on reasons to live. And it varies from a wide spectrum. In one particular, I remember in the school that I went to, one of the students put a sign up there that said his reason for living is so that he can take care of his dog, because if he wasn't there, nobody else would be able to take care of it. To me, that's showing a sense of responsibility, even in the face of what goes on in the villages. Also, on the next slide, you'll see the various agencies that we are collaborating with. And the Alaska Training Cooperative is one. And also, the Ironman race, there's a couple of people there that'll race for suicide prevention and give out cards and talk to people in villages about suicide.
So on these examples of collaboration, one example of collaboration and coordination is the partnership with the Alaska Community Foundation and Alaska Children's Trust. So with a very small capital increment of $25,000 several years ago, the council was able to pull together matching funds from the Alaska Community Foundation and the Alaska Children's Trust to create an opportunity for communities to apply for small project grants. Most of the state-funded suicide prevention is program-based. It's large scale. It takes a lot of work and heavy lifting. And so communities that wanted to do smaller events, culture camps, training for small numbers of staff, there weren't really funding opportunities. And so in addition to coordinating these resources and these efforts, we were also able to ensure that the projects funded were aligned with the state plan, which is also something that the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Education have agreed to, is that when they fund suicide prevention, it's coordinated and aligned with the plan. So those are some examples of how the council has engaged in this coordination of effort and collaboration.
And I wanted to interrupt and just recognize that we've been joined by Senator Gardner. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the next slide is in the middle. You'll see the number for Caroline. We support Caroline and all of its efforts. It's a small organization based in Fairbanks, and they operate during the day, and then whenever a call comes in and there's nobody there, it rolls over to the National Suicide Hotline. But they handle many, many calls, and the number keeps going up, but we're very grateful to them. Also, you'll see the pictures of the other areas that we collaborate in. And on the top is a statement, remember, you are not alone. I'd like to mention at this time that our youth representative has a program called You Are Not Alone. And she literally goes to, has spoken with thousands of kids in Alaska in talking about suicide. And we're very fortunate that she is able to do this. Right now, I think she's a freshman in college.
Yes, sir.
Right. And she lives in Anchorage and travels all over there. And in the summertime, she came down to Southeast and did some presentations down here. So we're really fortunate to have a young lady in that caliber that can help us with this effort, particularly with young people who would rather hear it from their own peers rather than some older people like myself.
We'll talk in the next two slides about the plan being a plan of action, a call to action. The Anchorage Rotary Club's campaign last year, You Can Save a Life, that has commercials actually airing now that feature Catherine Casello, the young woman that Chairman Martin was just referencing. So this was funded by the Anchorage Rotary and a PR firm in Anchorage, Spawn Ideas, and was supported by the council. We provided some technical assistance to help them craft their messaging. But it's an example of how Alaskans are responding to the call of action in the state plan and are working to ensure that they work together with communities rather than in a discoordinated or disjointed fashion. And so this campaign from the Rotary has been a wonderful addition to the communication strategies from the Department of Health and Social Services in Caroline.
On the next slide is a list of warning signs for people at risk of suicide. And these are some who are threatening to hurt or kill themselves, you know, talking about wanting to die. A lot of people think that when somebody talks about it, they're not going to do it. But in fact, it's the opposite. If they're talking about it, we really better listen. They look for ways to kill themselves by seeking access to firearms, pills, medication, and other means. Talking about and writing about death, dying, or suicide, when these actions are out of the ordinary for a person. Acting recklessly, endangering in risky activities, seemingly without thinking or paying attention. Experiencing traumatic mood changes. Expressing feelings of purposeless, or seeing no reason for going on. Another thing that's not on here is to look for is somebody that is giving away their valuable possessions and saying things like, I won't be needing this anymore. But at times like that, it's when it's really important that we listen to these people and try to comprehend what's going on in their mind. A lot of times, we might not be able to solve it, but by the fact that we're listening to them, it means a lot to that person. That's what they're looking for, is somebody to just talk to them and understand.
And in situations where you do recognize the warning signs with someone and you have engaged with them and either you yourself want additional guidance or you feel that they need additional support, that's when the call to Caroline is really important. And as Chairman Martin said, they're available 24/7.
We've had a couple of gatherings in Anchorage and Juneau. It was on an every other year basis. It's called the Casting the Net series. This year we were supposed to have our third one, but because of financial restrictions we weren't able to fund it, and besides there was a cutback on our travel, so we're not able to travel now until sometime after in the next fiscal year. But It was good because we had people from all over the state. We had regional areas, people gathering. We spent at least 2.5 days putting together a plan and then publishing it and being putting it on ourselves and the people of Alaska the duties that we have to do in order to fix this problem of suicide prevention. In there, we talk about every Alaskan has a lot to do, and if we're going to prevent suicide in our family, schools, workplaces, and communities, we have provided resources and information to help individuals. communities in the state of Alaska take action. Every life matters, your life matters, and you are not alone. Together, we can prevent suicide and save lives.
Unlike other suicide prevention plans around the nation, Alaska's state plan is one that provides strategies and resources at three levels. At an individual level, what can Kate do? At a community level, what can my community, Juno, do? And then at the state level, what can the state of Alaska do? It is not a plan that places all of the direction and obligation on the state. It is definitely unique among the 50 state plans, which I think is why we've seen the successful implementation that we have had.
Our state suicide prevention plan and strategy are based on the idea that suicide is a result of many causal factors, including mental health disorders, depression, alcohol and drug use and misuse, trauma, sudden loss, grief, economic, social and physical isolation, access to health care, chronic health conditions, lack of and loss of connection to culture, heritage, and or spiritual tradition, lack of social and family support.
And this is not an exclusive list. Things like nutrition, social isolation due to orientation or ethnicity, those kinds of things. So the council has attempted to educate and then to really operate in a way that recognizes the multidimensional nature of suicide and suicide prevention.
In our Casting the Net series, we came up with six goals on a statewide basis. The first one is Alaskans accept responsibilities for preventing suicide. Goal two is Alaskans effectively and appropriately respond to people at risk of suicide. Goal three is Alaskans communicate, cooperate, and coordinate suicide prevention efforts. Goal four, Alaskans have immediate access to the prevention, treatment, and recovery services they need. Goal five is Alaskans support survivors in healing. And goal six is quality data and research is available and used for planning, implementation, and evaluation of suicide prevention.
There are a multitude of strategies under each of these goals, which we did not include in the presentation because there are, I think, about 40 of them, but they are in the state plan. If you're interested in exploring the specifics of how we are reaching those goals.
And if you look at these goals and in this picture of the state, you will see that different regions had their own priorities on these goals. And since we're vast in land and differences among all the people, that some of the goals are different. And so each of the regional groups, they decided on what was more important to their region. On the next page, you'll see the statistics and the number of suicides in the past 12 years. And you can see that the number varies a little bit, but overall it's pretty consistent in the area of 140 to 150 people taking their lives every day. On a national level, the rate of suicide was 11 per 100,000. And in the last survey among the United States, that number has risen to 12.5 per 100,000. So overall, the whole country is seeing an increase in suicide. None of this data comes late because of the time it takes to process the data. But one thing we do know, that as of October of last year, we'd already exceeded the number of suicides in Alaska for all of 2014. And that was before the news of suicide and the news during October was had even happened. And so we're afraid that the number that's going to show up for 2015 is probably going to be about 180, which is a big increase in suicides for the state. It's different. You want to go ahead and cover that?
Yes, sir. So we've referenced Caroline a couple of times. Caroline is a nationally accredited crisis line based in Fairbanks and staffed by trained Alaskans 24/7. When calls come in, if they can't be answered by someone in the Caroline office in Fairbanks, they do roll over to another certified crisis line affiliated with the National Lifeline. Caroline receives thousands of calls every year and has experienced an increase in the number of calls over the last several years. 95% of calls received are answered in Fairbanks, which is a really high rate, and we want to ensure that when someone calls Caroline from a place like Nome or Queefleck, they talk to someone who can understand that experience. If you call someone in St. Louis, they may not understand why you can't go to the emergency room right away. And we don't want Alaskans to have to deal with that when they're in crisis. Caroline also has taken on an additional role of being a resource for people who want to help someone in crisis or who are trying to avoid reaching a point of crisis. And so that's why you see that Caroline reports that over 80% of the callers disclose a mental health or substance use disorder. They often have repeat callers who are struggling with either a mental health disorder or a behavioral health disorder that might not at that moment be experiencing a suicide crisis, but it's the access to Caroline that is preventing them from reaching the point of contemplating suicide. Caroline is currently funded by the state of Alaska. It is a critical component to our suicide prevention system. We have asked, and our coalitions have all answered the call to refer to Caroline. It's on all of their materials. You'll see it on most Department of Health and Social Services materials. I saw an opportunity at the elevator. We could post it by the elevator. So it is a widely advertised resource that Alaskans are using. They have added a text option to try to enhance the number of young people using the service. Right now it's mostly older young adults, so people in their late 20s and 30s, and then people older than that. So the text option is meant to enhance the appeal to young people so that they will access the resource.
One of our strategies is training, and the state of Alaska and its partners make training available to in evidence-based suicide prevention and intervention models accessible to all interested Alaskans. And you can see that the different agencies that are involved with the training curriculum, such as ASSIST, Youth Mental Health First Aid, QPR and Gatekeeper, and e-learning. The Juno Suicide Coalition, another organization that I'm a member of, has put a goal of, in the next 2 years, of bringing QPR training to at least 25% of the people in the Juno area that are over 18 years of age, and I think it's a remarkable effort that they will try to accomplish.
Access to these trainings often depends on there being a grant source that funds the training or a local organization that will subsidize the cost of providing the training. And so if you look at implementation reports over the years, the numbers per training fluctuate depending on the resources available to support the training. So at one point, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium was training hundreds and hundreds of people because they had grant funds to provide ASSIST and Safe Talk. In the past year, we've seen additional funds for youth mental health first aid. So those numbers have grown, and we expect those to continue to grow as they have funding to provide that. One of the stable sources of training is through the Department of Education and Early Development's e-learning program, because that's a state program that is supported not only by the Department of Education but by the council. And so that's an opportunity, a consistent opportunity to access training. But with other organizations, it's often grant dependent.
And just a follow-up on that e-learning, is that individualized one at a time, or is that group training?
Mr. Chairman, the e-learning network is a distance-delivered training that is most often used by educators and staff, although the public does have access to trainings, on a host of topics, including suicide prevention. And so the individual person engages with the training through a computer. It's a series of PowerPoint slides with questions and a quiz. It can be delivered on a big screen in a group, but it's also appropriate for sitting at home and doing it yourself to get your certification.
One of the studies that we look at very carefully is called Adverse Childhood Experiences, otherwise known as ACEs. It's traumatic events that occur during childhood adolescence. And some of these are abuse, neglect, domestic violence, household mental illness, household substance abuse, divorce of parents, incarceration of a parent. And there are a couple others that I think there's about 10 in total. But when we look at those based on the numbers of suicides, many times that a person will have as many as 7 of these adverse childhood experiences, and it's almost certain that a person at some point in time may attempt to take their life or is extremely at risk in taking their life. There's a behavioral risk factor surveillance survey, which we commonly call BRFIS because we always like to shorten things. And as data on ACEs in Alaska shows that 64% of Alaskan adults surveyed had experienced at least one ACE, and 27.4% had experienced 3 or more. Alaskans reporting 4 or more ACEs were far more likely to report fair or poor physical health, and more likely to report frequent mental distress, and higher numbers of days of pure mental health each month. A complete overview of BRFIS data and analysis is available online on our website at stopsuicidealaska.org. It's important that this information on ACEs needs to be known by all of us, because it's the key to bringing down the number. If we can get rid of the adverse childhood experiences, then our suicide problem will be drastically reduced. Suicide risk grows with increased number of ACEs, as I mentioned before. An ACE score of 7 or more increased the risk of suicide attempts 51-fold among children, adolescents, and 30-fold among adults. Nearly two-thirds, or 64%, of suicide attempts among adults were attributed to ACEs, and 80% of suicide attempts during childhood adolescence were attributed to ACEs. And the thing, too, about these adverse childhood experiences, they can come and raise their ugly head years later, and a person gets into their 30s, 40s, and 50s, too. And it brings, something will trigger and bring it to light. The idea, hopefully, is to stop those adverse childhood experiences from even happening. School-based suicide prevention. The Council and Department of Education and Early Development partner to offer suicide awareness and prevention program in 10 schools. This part of the broader school health and wellness, safe, supportive, and successful schools initiative. The initiative is supported by the positive behavior interventions and supports, school safety and health, youth risk behavior survey, suicide awareness and prevention, and e-learning efforts, among others. The comprehensive approach to student wellness further further the objective of Alaska's youth suicide prevention efforts and overcome goals of casting a net upstream. Department of Education and Early Development, with the support of a grant from the Department of Health and Social Services, provides the Promoting Health Alternative Schools and Community Partnership. And other things that are working in the schools is a program called Sources of Strength. And the school district in Juneau is very active in using Sources of Strength because it brings it at a peer level. See? Makes it easier to communicate with the young people.
So one of the other areas where school-based intervention is showing some very positive outcomes is in the Lower Kuskokwim School District. It's the only school district in the state of Alaska with a social work department where licensed clinical social workers are in the schools as permanent employees. They have had a social work department since 1985, and it's a way that students have access to mental health services in school, and that there are trained staff to help support a student in crisis, whether it's a suicide crisis, a mental health issue, a domestic violence issue, whatever that is. And so some of the themes we've seen in communities where school-based suicide prevention is having the best effect. They have trained adults in the school, whether it's through a social work department or through school nurses or teen health centers or the counseling school counselors. They have access to mental health services. We're going to talk about Project Aware just in a second that has embedded clinicians in three school districts. And they have peer-to-peer student support models. And so when we talk about what's working, those three things seem to be exceptionally important in Alaska when you're talking about school-based suicide prevention.
Access to effective services for behavioral health disorders is a key protective factor against suicide. Culturally relevant prevention and awareness promotion programs like that, and I apologize to my friends up north for mispronouncing Kungasvik Project and Iluun Tungyunum Project in Southwest Alaska have been found to strengthen protective factors and resiliency. With support from a multi-year federal grant from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and Department of Education and Early Development, has provided resources for mental health counselors in schools in the Kenai, Anchorage, Matsu School District. Project Aware includes the specific objective of increasing the number of students referred to and accessing community behavioral health services by 25%. The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium funds a rural aftercare coordinator at Alaska Psychiatric Institute to support patients submitted for suicidality and access treatment and supportive services in their home community after discharge. The AWARE project includes youth mental health first aid, mental health awareness, and responsive training for adults working with youth. Since April 1st, 2015, the Alaska Training Cooperative has trained over 900 Alaskans. The skills taught are being used. And an example here is a person that was trained in the mental health first aid, and where he talks about a youth in the church that he had a chance to talk to and bring that person out in being able to talk about their problem. And it directly attributes it to the tools that he got in learning from the youth mental health first aid. So that is something that we're really proud of, because it's actually working with our young people. What's next? We're going to continue implementation of casting the net upstream. By increased access to evidence-based suicide prevention training for all Alaskans. develop support evidence-based suicide prevention training for professionals. Support integration of behavioral health and primary care services. Encourage suicide screening, intervention of primary care practices. Support services, resources for parents and families. Expand the suicide knowledge and research base in Alaska. Refine communication strategies, taking advantage of emerging outlet. Evaluate statewide suicide prevention efforts in preparation for next planning phase. I'm going to review and update the casting net upstream. I engage stakeholders in review progress, planning for future. Refine strategies for 2017-2022. Publish our updated plan in January of next year. Mr. Chairman, member of the committees, I appreciate your allowing us time to present. And if you have any questions, we'll do our best to answer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and I'm sure the committee probably has questions. So we'll go ahead and start. Does anyone have questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to Kate and Bill for the great presentation. Definitely a very dedicated group of people trying to solve a very difficult problem. One of the things that's come up, and I just thought I'd mention to members of the committee, is just a role we can play in helping to accomplish this mission. Some of the strategies involve, you know, getting resources to individual Alaskans, and we are lucky that we have opportunities to communicate with, you know, our constituents, our neighbors, pretty frequently. So things like the CARE line, if you're looking for something in your electronic newsletter or your next coming print newsletter, mm-hmm. putting the resources for the CARE line in there could be something, or some of these training opportunities could be another opportunity. Now that the e-learning modules are available for, you know, everyday Alaskans, that's another opportunity. So as we're looking forward and we know we're going to have limited budgets, I know one of the concerns from this group, and it's been a really special experience for me, because some of the meetings are held in communities. So my first meeting, for example, was on Prince of Wales Island. And you really get a different, you know, different opportunity by being there and getting to talk to the people who are doing the direct services kind of work. You know, we won't be able to do as much of that now with the travel restrictions and the freeze. So now more than ever, we're going to have to, you know, link arms and make sure we share this information statewide, so that people know that there are resources available and that every life matters and that we all share in that message. So that's just sort of a comment and an ask of everyone, and if anybody else in the building is listening, that they hear it too. And a specific comment on the CARE line, we heard from the manager of that effort this fall during our Fairbanks meeting, and the number of calls is increasing, and it's getting harder and harder for them to take all those calls with an in-state person, which, as Kate mentioned, you know, is so important to have the cultural context and the, you know, sort of the geographical context of where someone is. So that's just something, you know, that seems to be a very important piece of this, that we know is sort of burdened now and having trouble, and just want to watch going forward to make sure we can maintain that service. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. Of course, we all know that funding is going to be pretty skinny this year and probably the next few years, but I'm curious as to whether or not the Mental Health Trust Fund would be any help to you in that capacity.
Representative Stutes, through the chair, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority does fund the council's outreach, our when we do a television ad or a print product. They do fund that, and then they do fund some innovative, over the years we've seen some innovative screening projects that they have funded as an attempt to support that effort to integrate behavioral health and primary care, because there is research and data that shows that many people who have died by suicide were in their primary care provider's office within the previous few months. So things like the IMPACT model, which IMPACT is an acronym that I don't know what it stands for, but it's a depression screening and treatment program. program that's delivered in a primary care setting. So they have funded those sorts of things, and through the small projects grants that they issue three times a year, often there are community-based suicide prevention projects in those every cycle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Kungusvik program I've been a big supporter of because it focuses on the culturally relevant aspects of suicide prevention. And I'm curious, does the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council collaborate much with the folks who work on the Kungusvik program so that you can take what's working in the small part of the state where it is currently in the Alakanak area, Emonic in that area there, and try to use it in other parts of the state that are also rural?
So, Representative Foster, through the chair. So Dr. Stacy Rasmus at the Center for Alaska Native Health Research is really the person to answer this question, but I'm going to attempt to. Because they have presented to the council over the years as that model was developed with the National Institutes of Health grant in the beginning. And what they have emphasized is that is a particularly UPIC model, and what is actually translatable is their process, the participatory process, where first of all, no one goes in and tells anyone what they should be doing or ought to be doing. They are invited, and then they support the community's identification of the problem they want to solve and then how they want to use their traditions and traditional ways of knowing to solve that problem. And then it builds from there. And that is something the council has not only learned from the Center for Alaska Native Health Research and the folks involved in the Kungusvik model, but has implemented through our planning. Our planning is a participatory planning process, which is incredibly labor-intensive and unlike any other state health planning. But the plan, casting the net upstream, is actually Alaskans telling the council what they want to do to solve the problem, not the council telling them what to do. And so making access to that process available is definitely something that the council has learned about, and it kind of models that. But Kungusvik doesn't necessarily translate outside of that particular part of the state and their culture.
And that's
Foster, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad to hear that. And you're exactly right. What works in one part of the state doesn't work in other parts of the state. But I think the process of trying to integrate culturally relevant aspects of suicide prevention is the important thing, and I think that's something that can work in Western Alaska, it can work in Interior Alaska, it can work in Southeast Alaska, and so I certainly do hope that there is continued collaboration between the two entities, because I think it's a successful model. So thank you.
Representative Vasquez.
Thank you for your presentation. I would like to have, if you could submit to Mr. Chairman, for the past 5 years, the amount of the contributions made by the Mental Health Trust and the percentage of your budget that consists of. In other words, just your budget is $100. If they contributed, last year, $10, I'd like to see that. And I'd like to see the total budget that you have and how your budget is allocated to the different functions.
Go ahead.
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, we can do that. The council actually does not receive any funds directly from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, so that's a pretty easy answer. The communication strategy that they fund, they hold the money and they let us tell them how we want to spend it. So, and it's $25,000. So it's a pretty small proportion of the council's budget. If you look at the state budget, the council actually looks like it has a very large budget of over $600,000. But on July 1st of every year, we give $475,000 to the Department of Education. We don't touch it. That is the school-based suicide prevention program. So the council's budget is actually about 200 and something. But we will provide all of that in writing to the chairman for the committee.
Thank you, and we'll distribute it to the full committee.
Thank you.
Did you have another question, Representative? Representative Vasquez.
On page 12 of PowerPoint number 12, for the record, that has data from the Bureau of Vital Statistics shows that 167 Alaskans died by suicide in 2014. And then it has a chart from year 2003 through 2004, the rate per 100,000 and the actual number of suicides. In looking at this, for instance, in 2003, you have the rate of 20.2 per 100,000, and then in 2014, you have 22.7. So there's actually an increase, and I know there was a decrease in 2009 and 2011, 19 point something in each year, and 2006, 2005, but it hovers around the same numbers. Are there best practices that we may be missing? What are other states doing? Can we improve this? Are we moving? I mean, to me, it doesn't seem over the past 10 years. And I appreciate this effort, and I know about this effort way before I, you know, got into the legislature. I'm very aware of what it entails, but, and I do have, I really think that care line does help individuals. I know of individuals that have used that particular assistance, but it seems to me that we're not moving the needle that much, and I'm just wondering, what is it that we're doing that's not as effective as it can be? I mean, it's just a friendly question. It's not meant to attack your program or anything or your efforts or your goodwill in this, but how can we move the needle more? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's moving that much.
Well, Ms. Vasquez, through the chair, I really think that the council and other suicide enterprises has made a great effort and a contribution to reducing the number of suicides. It's really a complicated issue. I think if we had a solution, we'd have fixed it years ago. But one of the things that I need to mention too is that the reporting process in earlier years was pretty well skewed because there were many instances of suicides that were not recorded as suicides, and in only the last few years that the efforts of having true numbers has come to the surface. And so I think that even though we feel like we've made great strides and the numbers look like they haven't changed, I really think that we have, because there's more collaboration between us and the tribes, which was important for us to get, because it's not something that they have answers for, because it's pretty much a new thing, especially with youth suicide. When I was growing up in my age group, there were no youth suicides. It's relatively in the last 40 to 45 years that has happened. And so when we go to the elders and say, what's wrong with this? How can we fix it? Because we do that all the time. And in this case, it's like, I don't know. The response we get is, I don't know, because they didn't experience those things. But just the change in culture, the change in the growing up process with young people, I think has been really overwhelming. And that's the thing that we're really trying to work on.
Representative Vasquez.
I also note for the record that in some cultures there may be under reporting in previous years also because of the shame that has been brought about by admitting that a relative or family member has committed suicide. I mean, so there may have been underreporting previously.
Mm-hmm. So. Reverend Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add, if we think about some of the work on ACEs, for example, the research just happened in the late 80s and early 90s that started to be published and then, you know, incorporated. So I think part of it is, you know, we're just still learning a lot about, you know, sort of the interconnectedness of certain things like the childhood traumas and the impact it has on suicide. So I think really for us that the challenge is now that we have more information that can be a better guide of where we can make impacts that, you know, that we take it as a call to action and do more in those areas. But sort of the research piece of it is fairly new. So I think that's part of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Along those lines, so the council and its partners at the Department of Health and Social Services and education in particular have really committed to evidence-based prevention practices as a way to ensure that we try to do what works, and we are seeing successes in places that are implementing those. But actually evaluating is what we're doing, the answer. That's goal 6 of the plan that no one thinks is fun but me. And when you're faced with the idea of, am I going to fund a prevention program that saves lives, or am I going to fund a research project that tells me whether that program saves lives, that's often a really difficult decision to make. But we are at a place where we need to be able to evaluate our suicide prevention system and what we're doing if we want to make thoughtful decisions about how we move forward. That's an expensive proposition, but it's important enough that it's a whole goal in the plan, and I tend to beat the goal 6 drum because we need that information in order to make good decisions about how to move forward.
Thank you. And, you know, since we were estimating that 2015 may be 180, which would be the highest on any portion on the graph, if there's some explanation that suicides weren't reported earlier, if we have any documentation of that, because when we look at the data, the data would say that, you know, we're doing some very extensive efforts, but the success of those efforts, you know, has to be questioned as whether we're getting right. And then on your, I think it's page 12 or so, Lower Kuskokwim School District has been having a social work department for all this time, but are you reporting to us that Lower Kuskokwim School District has lowered the suicide rate, or is that where there's a problem with suicides? I mean, I know in Western Alaska there's some school districts and some areas that have had an increase in suicides, and so, you know, we talk about some programs, but here's a place where we have a social work department. Has that been effective in decreasing the suicide rate in Lower Kuskokwim compared to other similar parts of Western Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, the social work department and Lower Kuskokwim School District report reduced incidents among enrolled students. That is not the entire region. And we see that same outcome in the Northwest Arctic. Among enrolled students who have access to the prevention programming, we see reduced incidents. Here in Juneau, enrolled students. That may or may not have an impact on the region because our numbers are very small. A difference in one or two can change our rate substantially, especially in a community of, you know, 400 people. So that's where the evaluation piece, I think, is most critical, because if we try to evaluate the success of our programs based on their rate or their number, when the program doesn't reach everyone in the community, I think we do a disservice to everybody. So that's why we try to be careful that for people touched by that program, yes, they are reporting a reduced incidence of suicide.
Okay, good. I'm glad that it's clarified because, you know, when the suicide rates are possibly going up, we need to make sure that what we're doing has some efficiency in there. I guess Representative, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for all the work you do. A couple questions. Well, first of all, you talked about throwing the net upstream and reducing the ACEs number. Obviously, that's a lot easier said than done. So if you can bring someone's ACEs score down, the likelihood of a suicide incident is lower. And we've certainly been talking about that around this table for a while. Is that message also getting out to communities in that if a family or a community is aware of this, they might be more sensitive to their social situation and those kind of things that would, and some of these results obviously you may not see for a decade or as you're saying, people in their 30s and 40s are now experiencing trauma and acting on it. So it could take longer than, you know, we'll be around to talk about, but you are working on those kinds of things as well, right?
Representative Wool, through the chair, so I wear three hats. In addition to this hat, I am the director for the Alaska Mental Health Board and then the advisory board on alcoholism and drug abuse. The Alaska Mental Health Board has worked diligently to make Alaska-specific ACEs data available to help guide policy like they do in Washington, and then to share that information broadly. Patrick Sidmore is our ACEs person in the office, and if you Google Alaska Adverse Childhood Experiences, it goes to the page where all of our research and reporting has been. He has, I think he said he just hit 2,700 people trained on how ACEs affects Alaskans. And we are hearing from folks like school districts. The Juneau Suicide Coalition had a trauma-informed summit last winter. So a direct example of how this information is helping guide suicide prevention in particular. But I know you have Dr. Folletti coming at some point on this session. And of course, he's the expert. But the desire all over the state to understand how this affects Alaskans in particular is huge. And there are multiple people working on that. The Alaska Pediatric Partnership, the Alaska Children's Trust, our offices, the Center for the Childhood Trauma Center in Anchorage. So if you wanted kind of an overview of all that work, we could provide that if it would be helpful.
Sure. Thank you.
And we will have a overview more in depth on ACEs specifically. And, of course, I don't think we can look at the Suicide Prevention Council and say, you know, you're going to be able to, with your program, solve abuse, neglect, domestic violence, household mental illness, household substance abuse, divorce of parents, incarceration of parents. I mean, you know, we are talking about multiple things across. So. But I did want to bring back, and I talked to you a little bit beforehand, and I put out on everybody's desk there the CAPCM3 study from 2015. I didn't bring the other one, a 2014 study from New Zealand on vitamin D and depression. But on the CAPCM3 study, this is youth, adolescents, and they did the youth behavioral study, in Arabic, because this is a study that's done in Iran, and they also tested vitamin D levels in 1,100 students and compared those with where they were, and they found that you had between 50% and 80% more self-reported anger, anxiety, poor quality sleep, sadness, depression, and worry in those that had low levels of vitamin D, and you had over 400% more in those that were low vitamin D on worry. And so I guess I am concerned that we have evidence-based clinical studies, we have randomized control studies out of New Zealand, showing that depression, worry, poor quality sleep, anxiety, anger issues in adolescence is associated with low vitamin D. And I'm concerned that the Suicide Prevention Council has not one mention of nutrition or low vitamin D in the plan. And we did a study, and we've report, you know, this committee has seen this data before. We put it out. I think I sent it to the Suicide Prevention Council. And we have looked at a number of these studies. I mean, we have several other suicide prevention studies as they relate to low vitamin D levels. And yet there seems to be no description of or utilization of evidence-based studies to address suicide prevention on the wellness side. In other words, not waiting until somebody is saying, I'm feeling like I might want to commit suicide, but actually keeping people healthy before they reach that point. So I've passed this out to the committee again. I'm hopeful that you will take it back to the committee and look at the council and take a look at nutrition and find out whether we have not only associations, but we also have studies that show that they're double-blind, randomized control studies that show that there are more of these that occur. Few of them occur when people have adequate levels of vitamin D, and we know that we're the furthest north state in this nation, and we have some of the lowest levels of vitamin D, and we have some of the highest rates of suicide. We have some of the highest rates of many other illnesses that have been directly related. So I guess I'm a little disappointed in that, and I want to express that to you so that you can take it back to the full working group and make sure that we are looking at evidence-based medicine and evidence-based research and at least putting the information out to communities. I'm not saying that we need to go in and mandate something, but if communities don't know that their members have low vitamin D levels, which could well be associated with, exactly what the research is saying, anger, anxiety, poor quality sleep, worry, depression, which are all associated with those kind of things, then I think we're missing a piece of the puzzle to get ahead of the problem. Because I think that's much easier to tackle than the ACEs that we just talked about, because those are very difficult issues, you know, abuse, neglect, those things to address. And we know we can do it for less than $10 a year per person. So I wanted to add that as a request for the Suicide Prevention Council to consider, and we'd be happy to present you all of the information that we've gleaned from all over the world on depression and low vitamin D levels. So, Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I did hear Kate say nutrition, so I do want to let you know that that actually was a big topic of our last meeting and a presentation, because there's also research that shows omega fatty acids are in a good health indicator for suicide prevention. So on the web of causality, the chronic health conditions, I think broadly speaks to the issue of nutrition. But perhaps in our statewide plan, we can talk in more specifics about some of the nutritional opportunities related to directly to suicide prevention, and so definitely take that to heart. But I don't want you to feel that nobody is thinking of that, because we actually and didn't come out just until now, but we did spend quite a bit of our time at our last meeting talking about nutrition and actually looking at this prison population specifically and some of the mental health challenges, and thinking about, you know, again, what are those folks getting to eat, and could there be the things that would improve behavioral outcomes and criminal behavior as a result of better nutrition too. So very complex issues, but I'm just thinking, you know, we're rewriting the plan right now for the next 5 years, and so there is an opportunity that maybe we could put more of a nutrition sheet in there or something like that, or something that could become a resource for communities. That would be a great thing, I think.
Yeah, thank you on that. And you know, we, on the omega-3, omega-6 fatty acid balance, you know, we have the, we presented to the council, to the committee here, the Department of Defense, the full panel, expert panel on nutrition, looking at nutritional armor for the war fighters, and they specifically recommended that it was an immediate concern for the Army to come in and say, we need to change that balance of omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids for specifically for depression. And so, anyway, there are some things that I think that we can be doing that are much simpler than trying to change the lifestyle of, that people have adopted, and or interactions in families without interfering with those. So I think that I would like to point out that the Alaska Care Wellness brochure that just came out, you know, had a big section on vitamin D. And so for the first time, we are seeing the state moving that way for state employees, but I don't see anything of us telling the rest of the communities across the state of Alaska that it's important for mental health. And so I think that when we look on the continuum of things, the cost and benefit of this, we could incorporate it so much more on a cost-benefit basis than not replacing, but, you know, as an addendum to where we are. So I know that's, you know, something that I've been passionate about, but I'm not passionate about it just because it's there. I'm passionate about because the continuous amount of research, when we're talking about 2014 and 2015, and we, now we've got 2016 research coming out as well, we know there pre-publication stuff that is going to be showing us these same advances, that we need to incorporate the latest data, not reach back too far. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a different topic, in looking at the rates and seeing that the rate per 100,000 is fairly constant, does that take into consideration sort of the rural-urban divide? In other words, if the state population has increased in a urban area and the rural area population has stayed constant or even gone down, has the suicide rate reflected the population distribution of those places? And part two of the same question would be, how does it compare to other sort of rural communities, either native or non-native, or, you know, say in northern Canada or southwestern U.S. In other words, is it the same experience happening in multiple places? And I noticed Mr. Martin made the anecdotal story that years and years ago, young people in villages weren't committing suicide, but now you're seeing more of that. So is that also happening in other places besides Alaska?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, I'm going to try to answer each of those questions. So the council reports both numbers and the statewide rate because for a long time we only reported rates. And when you looked at a map at rates by census area, it looked like it was a rural problem because the rate in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks was lower. But that's because we have more people. And when you look at the numbers on the same map, the numbers are actually in our urban areas because there's more people.
Sure.
So what's in the presentation is the statewide rate and the statewide number. We can provide it by region. We don't typically go down to census areas because in some census areas it's less than 20 incidences and that's not statistically significant, but we can give you the by the regions. Typically rural regions have a higher rate and a lower number than urban areas. What has happened over the last few years is where Alaska was consistently the state with the highest rate in the nation, over the last few years, we're not. Unfortunately, it's not because we got any better. It's because other states, typically rural western states, got worse. That's one thing Chairman Martin talked about that the national rate has ticked up. We have remained steady until potentially on this past year. So we're not number one, but that's really because, unfortunately, I think it's Montana,
Wyoming,
one of those, got worse. So I feel like that's some of your questions. On the question about the increased incidence of adolescent suicide among indigenous people, that would be something I would want to refer back to some research on before I answered that definitively. Mm-hmm. Part of the issue is, as Chairman Martin talked about, that our reporting just in the last 10 years has changed quite a bit to become more rigorous. If you look much further back, the numbers are just not, sure. you're not confident in the numbers. And that's not just true here. That's true like in the Northwest Territories and New Zealand and other places with indigenous populations that are experiencing the consequences of colonialization. So, but I'll see what we can figure out and provide that through the chairman.
Thank you. I was just curious.
So thank you very much for coming today and presenting to us, and we'll look forward to your new plan, and we'll, if there's any questions or anything that this committee can help you with, we'd be happy to, share and participate, and as things come up, we will continue to send them to the council for consideration. So, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two things. Dr. Folletti will be here in Juneau on February 8th and 9th, and we'll be hosting a public event on Monday, February 8th. So hopefully anybody listening, if they're interested, could write that down. And he's going to be talking about his research and a lot of interest from the Native community here. So I'm hoping.
And that's on ACES.
Right? On ACES, yep, because he's the lead researcher on that. And then because we are rewriting the plan, I just wanted to say here in this forum that perhaps we could have almost, we've had sort of work session meetings before like we did on Medicaid. Perhaps the committee could host something like that so we could engage stakeholders on a statewide basis to try and make sure we're hearing, from the right people. That would be a really great opportunity because we have the challenge of trying to make sure we're getting out to the right people, but there's a whole network of people kind of watching what the legislature's doing that might not, also be clued in on that.
Yeah, that would be really good. We'll try and do that. And by the way, on the 9th, we have Dr.
Folletti.
Yeah, he is going to be here before the committee.
Oh, great. So. Wonderful.
Yeah, can I just add the time and place for Dr. Folletti on Monday night is at the A&B Hall, Elizabeth Bradridge Hall, at 6 o'clock on Monday. And then he'll also present at the Walter Sobeloff Building on Tuesday from noon till 1 o'clock. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming again. And we need to go on to our next presentation, Health and Social Services. Let's see. We have Beth Davidson, State Health Information Technology Coordinator.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and we have someone here that will work on the slides, but we don't have your slideshow up yet. So if you have a few introductory remarks, go ahead.
Sure, thank you. I just wanted to thank the House Health and Social Services Committee for inviting me to present today about the Health Information Exchange. If possible, I'd like to save questions for the end since I am on the telephone. It might help a little bit with the talking over the telephonic issue that sometimes happens when people are presenting over a phone.
Sure, we'll do that. If there's a clarification question, we might insert that, but other than that, we'll save questions to the end. So, welcome, Ms. Davidson. Go ahead.
So, Sarah, if you can switch to slide number 2. My name is Beth Davidson. I am the State Health Information Technology Coordinator for the Department of Health and Social Services. And today I wanted to provide an overview of a project where the department utilized an electronic connection to the statewide health information exchange to allow healthcare providers to submit required public health data to the state in a simple, cost-effective, and secure method. The original reason why this project was implemented was to address the requirement under the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Meaningful Use Program, where providers needed to be able to submit public health data to their public health agency. As a result of this project, we have found that we have not only provided additional benefits to the provider, but also additional benefits to public health, which I will talk about a little bit later in my presentation. And Sarah, if you can switch to slide 3. So health information exchange has been around for many years. You could even say that the use of the fax machine is a type of health information exchange. In recent years, though, health information exchange nationally has been headed towards electronic means of health information exchange and utilizing electronic information technology to do that. To provide you some historical aspects of Alaska's health information exchange, in May 2009, Senate Bill 133 was passed, and this bill was to create a statewide health information exchange that is interoperable and compliant with state and federal specifications and protocols for exchanging health records and data. In March 2010, Alaska eHealth Network was awarded a contract by the Department of Health and Social Services to be the nonprofit board and organization that would procure and manage our statewide health information exchange. In November 2010, Alaska eHealth Network signed a software as a service contract with Orion Health to provide health information exchange services. That explains software as a service a little bit for you. Software as a service is often what you might consider cloud-based. It's a piece of software and technology. It's not actually a piece of hardware. So it's not actually the computer that sits at your desk. It's more of a web-based software solution. In February 2011, a pilot of 3 entities in the Fairbanks area began to use the Alaska Health Information Exchange. And about a year later, in February 2012, the federal rules under the Office of the National Coordinator Health Information Exchange Cooperative Agreement Grant changed, and Alaska's Health Information Exchange was required to implement and demonstrate push-based exchange. And push-based exchange is a really secure encrypted email. And we needed to do this for more than 300 participants before we were able to move along to a more robust query-based health information exchange. And query-based health information exchange is where providers' electronic health record solutions are actually interfaced and connected to the statewide health information exchange to actually do the exchange. So it's system to system versus a person actually logging into an email solution, attaching a document, let's say, a referral to a specialist or maybe a transition of care document and emailing it to another healthcare provider. Here in Alaska, for our push-based solution, so our secure encrypted email, we use a solution called Direct Secure Messaging. And it's often most used to send referrals of patients between healthcare providers, usually from a primary care provider to a specialist. It is also used for provider consults and discussions about a mutual patient. It's used for sharing transition of care documentation and for also transmitting electronic protected health information to the state of Alaska from outside healthcare organizations and stakeholders. In February of 2013, the Department of Health and Social Services received permission from the Office of the National Coordinator to move our health information exchange into full production mode, meaning we were allowed to use the query access and provided electronic health record solutions could be connected to the health information exchange for the system-to-system exchange. Here in Alaska, our health information exchange utilizes secure encrypted data exchange using standards developed specifically for healthcare. The only person who can access and view a patient's data is the patient's healthcare provider, and this is done by using decryption keys in the system. The sharing of health information electronically eliminates the need for faxing, copying, hand-carrying medical records from provider to provider, which is often unsecure and unknown, especially with faxing, on the other end is actually going to receive the records. Some of the benefits of health information exchange are things like faster and more effective emergency treatment, the support of telehealth or telemedicine activities, improved public health disease reporting, avoidance of duplicate testing, negative drug interactions, and allergic reactions. And I'd like to provide to you today an example, a real-world example here in Alaska where the health information exchange was actually used. There was an 85-year-old male patient that was seen with weakness and numbness in his hands in Anchorage. This gentleman came from rural Alaska, and he was transported into Anchorage. And he was appropriately diagnosed and started on high-dose steroids and had some improvement in symptoms, and so he was returned to his home community. Back in his home community, a local health care provider was informed by a neighbor of this gentleman that while some of his symptoms had been abated, others had not, and his mental capacity seemed to be slipping. And so the healthcare provider in the community logged into the health information exchange and was granted permission by the patient ward to see the patient's records and reviewed the patient's lab work and found out that the patient had also been diagnosed with a new onset of diabetes and anemia. The patients themselves had failed to inform the healthcare provider back in rural Alaska in his home community about these other diagnoses. And so the provider didn't know about that until they actually logged into the health information exchange and realized that these other diagnoses were causing this patient's hyperglycemia to get significantly worse because of the high-dose steroids the patient had been put on. Without that access to the health information exchange, the healthcare provider back in the rural Alaska community would have never known about these comorbid conditions that would have changed the health care plan for the patient. And because the provider found out about it, about the conditions, they were able to start the patient on the appropriate medication and be able to manage the patient's blood pressure along with the dealing with the original symptoms of weakness and hand numbness, and was able to get the patient back into a plan of care that was working for the patient, and the patient's overall health was improving. And all of that was done from the patient's home community, where the patient didn't have to travel at all, and with a healthcare provider who had access to the medical records for the patient from when they were seen down here in Anchorage. So it's kind of a real-world example of how a health information exchange can be utilized. So Sarah, if you can switch to slide 4. What I wanted to speak to you today about was specifically a project that the Department of Health and Social Services completed in 2015. This project was to allow healthcare providers to submit public health data for immunizations, electronic laboratory results, and syndromic surveillance through the health information exchange to the department through our enterprise service bus. Here in the Department of Health and Social Services, we have a tool called an enterprise service bus. It is a piece of information technology that securely and discreetly connects different information systems within the department using a combination of open technology standards to access, move and or transform information in one system record so it can be effectively and appropriately used in related systems, but without the overhead of direct access to the system of record. By using common tools and support personnel across many required connections, the Enterprise Service Bus actually reduces the cost of creating, maintaining, and monitoring these connections, avoiding the duplication of effort and other losses associated with implementing the same connections as a direct system-to-system connection. So, in a sense, by using an Enterprise Service Bus, we are making connections between our different information technology systems here in the department. Instead of connecting them all separately, we connect everything to the enterprise service bus and it allows us to move and transform data around more appropriately and faster and in a more cost-effective way. So if you can please switch to slide 5. We had several project tasks associated with the project to specifically allow for the public health data to come over to the department from the health information exchange. We initially figured out that some of our information systems here in the department, particularly the immunization system, VacTrack, and the electronic laboratory reporting system, AK STARS, needed to have some upgrades in order for them to be able to effectively communicate with the health information exchange. So we utilized funds received from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act, which is also known as the HITECH Act, to make system upgrades to those two systems so that way we would be able to successfully connect them to the health information exchange. At the same time as we're upgrading those public health systems, we were also working with Alaska eHealth Network to design and implement the electronic connection necessary between the health information exchange and our enterprise service bus. And additionally, specifically for syndromic surveillance, the department and Alaska eHealth Network worked with the Center for Disease Control to design and implement electronic connection between the health information exchange and the Center for Disease Control's tool, BioSense. Specifically for syndromic surveillance, we don't actually here within the Department of Health and Social Services have our own information technology system that captures syndromic surveillance data. We actually utilize the Center for Disease Control's tool BioSense. And so our staff, providers, send their data to the Health Information Exchange, and it's sent to BioSense in a de-identified aggregate level. And BioSense, it captures that data, and then our staff actually log in via a website in order to access the syndromic surveillance data for Alaska. Once we made all the systems connections completed, we were able to proceed with testing of actually having providers send test data across the connection from the Health Information Exchange over to the state. And we did that testing in parallel with how data had been transmitted to the state of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services Public Health for years to make sure that data was flowing correctly and that it was being received timely and it was in the right structure. And after a period of time, once we were assured that all the data was being received necessary and as expected, we finalized the connections, and now healthcare providers are able to utilize the Health Information Exchange to transmit their public health data. Sarah, can you please switch to slide 6?
Okay.
There are a lot of benefits to providers for having the Health Information Exchange connected to the department's enterprise service bus and having a single connection versus multiple connections between disparate systems. The biggest benefit is that it's more cost effective. It's very expensive for providers to connect their electronic health record solution to multiple sources. Generally speaking, the electronic health record vendor will charge them for every single one of those connections. And in some cases, those costs are quite high depending on the electronic health record solution. And so by allowing providers who are onboarded and connected to the Health Information Exchange to transmit their data to the department via the Health Information Exchange, it's one connection versus multiple connections, and it's more cost-effective. It's also more timely now than in old manners. Previous to having electronic connections, like I said, we were using faxing, we were copying, we were using the U.S. Postal Service. And so by having an electronic connection, we actually are getting real-time data, and providers are having real-time responses for their submission of their data. There's also usually less errors. There's less human intervention when the systems are transmitting the data versus a human reading a record off a piece of paper and retyping it into another system or mailing it or handwriting it. There's usually less errors. And the other advantage of the Health Information Exchange is that we have ensured that it's a secure data transmission, and we know that it's secure and it's encrypted, and that it's getting to the right people at the right time. And so if you can please switch to slide 7. There's also benefits to the Department of Health and Social Services, and they're pretty much a lot of the same benefits. We have improved data. Since we have completed this project, the Division of Public Health has seen a tremendous amount of more data that they are able to now use to better perform their services. And these are things such as monitoring health status to identify community health problems, diagnose and investigate health problems and health hazards in a community, mobilize community partnerships to identify and solve health problems, and research new insights and innovative solutions to health problems. Some real examples that the Division of Public Health, where this project has supported their efforts this year in 2015 and now headed into 2016, they have incorporated the BioSense data, which is the syndromic surveillance data, into weekly flu snapshots to get a sense of activity statewide. This is a fairly new activity for them, so they really haven't had their aha moment or an early alert about a flu outbreak occurring here in the state, but they have previously had very paltry clinical surveillance, and so by having a significant boost in having a syndromic surveillance, they really believe that they will be able to better predict and provide good situational awareness for outbreaks across our state. And they're hoping to be able, in the coming year, to be able to expand their analysis of data to include non-infectious things as well, things like asthma or injuries due to falls, or even things like carbon monoxide poisoning. For electronic laboratory results, they've had a sizable gain in efficiency because the lab results, which would have previously been faxed, mailed, or handwritten, are now coming exclusively electronically through the Health Information Exchange. And this has saved a tremendous amount of time, both on the Department of Health and Social Service Division of Public Health side, but also with the labs that are out there, whether it's a lab at a hospital or a lab, a national lab, or even the state labs. So they are seeing a reduction in data entry and manual efforts that are taking when they had to have handwritten lab results sent over to the Department of Health and Social Services. They're also starting to see some reports come in electronically that have allowed Division of Public Health to speed up detection of possible cluster situations, things like clusters of salmonella poisoning going on or other common exposures to things that occur across the states. And so by getting electronic laboratory results and syndromic surveillance results, they're starting to be able to better predict this stuff, and we'll also be able to better respond to the communities and support those communities when outbreaks occur. And Sarah, if you can switch to slide 8. There are a lot of future plans that we have for the health information exchange that the Department of Health and Social Services is evaluating and continues to evaluate. Some of the examples that we are evaluating or in the process of setting up is the ability for healthcare providers to transmit HIV or other sensitive disease reporting to the Division of Public Health. Other things would be the facility discharge reporting that is required, Alaska birth defects registry reporting. And we're also looking into and evaluating behavioral health data reporting to incorporate the behavioral health providers and their abilities to communicate not only to the state, but also to primary care providers by utilizing the health information exchange. Some other future plans that we have for the health information exchange: claims data being available to patients via the personal health record in the health information exchange. And this would be claims data for Medicare, Medicaid, and other insurances, third-party administrators. This would allow patients to view their clinical data along with their claims data at the same time and help them to be able to make more informed decisions about their own health care and play a more active role in their own care of health. We also have been evaluating the possibility of utilizing the Health Information Exchange as an all-payer claims database. And this kind of goes along with a point that I just made previously. An all-payer claims database is a type of database designed to inform cost containment and quality improvement efforts. This data usually consists of service-level information based on valid claims processed by health payers. And in all payer claims database, to protect the patient's identity and ensure privacy, patient identifiers are always encrypted, aggregated, and suppressed. We are also looking at clinical quality measure reporting by healthcare providers to meet state and federal program requirements via the Health Information Exchange. There are a lot of programs that are request, whether they're state or federal programs, clinical quality measure reporting. This could be something as simple as a healthcare provider, you ask all of your patients who are over the age of 13 if they are smokers, and depending on how they respond, you would provide them education materials about smoking cessation and becoming a non-smoker. That's an example of a clinical quality measure. There are thousands of them that are out there. The biggest ones that are most prevalent right now are the clinical quality measures that are associated with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Meaningful Use Program. And as a way to simplify and streamline the process for healthcare providers in submitting their clinical quality measure data, we are evaluating the opportunity for them to be able to submit that through the Health Information Exchange to the Department of Health and Social Services, and then we would share that data to the appropriate program as necessary. And the last thing that we are evaluating as a potential future project for the Health Information Exchange is connecting the Health Information Exchange to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program Solution, AWARE-XE, it's capital A, capital R, capital A, sorry, capital A, W-A-R, lowercase x, capital E. I don't quite know how they pronounce the acronym. This would allow healthcare providers who submit their controlled substance prescription information to do so through the Health Information Exchange instead of having to log in or access a different solution. It would allow potentially for real-time batch submission and help improve the quality of the data in the prescription drug monitoring program solution to support that program. And that is my presentation today about the project that we did connecting the Health Information Exchange for public health reporting, if there are any questions.
Representative Stute?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that this is a question as much as it is. Maybe I didn't understand this. I understand that this is an avenue to report to the public health the required information. And then my ears perked up when you said, and then we're going to look into asthma, and you went on and on. And it sounds to me before too long you're going to have physicians reporting everything that goes on with every patient they see so you can keep track of them. And or at least that's how I'm interpreting this, and that alarms me.
Representative Steve Sue, the chair, that is definitely not the intention of the Department of Health and Social Services. The Health Information Exchange is really designed to support providers, healthcare providers in the community, to be able to work together with their mutual patients in order to be able to share their patients' data as necessary to support referral to specialists, to support transition of care, to support the cooperation between healthcare providers. In particular, we see primary care and behavioral health because patients often cross over between those two areas and often are seen by both. To support emergency rooms not being a primary care provider for patients and actually helping those patients actually find a true primary care provider and let the emergency rooms deal, you know, with emergencies. That's the real intention of the Health Information Exchange. Syndromic surveillance data is de-identified aggregate data that produces data for the state and for the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Public Health, that helps them to identify if there's outbreaks occurring across the state. So for the most part, it's about things around flu and salmonella poisoning and those sort of things. But being able to do trend analysis for non-infectious diseases can also help the Division of Public Health to be able to support communities if there are other trends that are occurring or they're starting to see trends occur from this de-identified data. But we certainly don't have the intention of providers submitting every ounce of data that they ever possibly capture within their electronic health record solution.
Follow-up,
Representative Stute.
Thank you. Well, I understand what you're saying, but it's still a concern to me when I lost my train of thought there for a minute.
Representative Stute, could I interject a question or a clarification? The data that would be coming in through this, is that all the data that we have that are already required reportable diseases, or is this the full panoply of other non-reportable diseases? I think that's where the concern is. Are we at this point expanding by the e-network the reportable data, reportable diseases to the full range of things, or is it still going to be on whatever has been determined to be reportable incidences?
Thank you. Through the chair, it is only going to be what is required under federal and state law for reportable diseases.
Okay. So that's good because we didn't quite get that in the presentation. So, Representative Stutes, with that clarification, would you like to follow up?
So you're not talking about prescriptions which are not reportable, I mean, to the Department of Public Health, and you're not talking about people with asthma, which I was sure I heard you mention, but maybe I didn't.
Representative Stutes, through the chair, no, those are currently not reported under federal or state law.
They are not currently But your anticipation, if I understood correctly, is to expand this program to include them. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is not the intention, so I'm sorry if that was your understanding from my presentation. That would have been my fault for misspeaking about that. That wasn't my intention to say that.
Okay, well, just to suffice it to say, my alarms went up because I thought that was a pretty invasive way to look at this, and I worried about the HIPAA consequences. And there's, aside from the fact that, you know, without the reforms, the Department of Health and Social Services seem to sometimes have trouble keeping track of their own information, and it would be very easy for this to get in the wrong hands. Thank you.
And I just want to clarify. So the opportunity here is that the reports will come in much more quickly. They'll be electronic. The clusters of those things can be seen, but these will be the same reports that would have come in by paper or fax, but then they're sitting on a desk someplace, but all the data would still be the same data that was there for required. Is that correct?
For the chair, yes, that is correct. I would like to add that we are now receiving reports that are required under federal law and state law that we never used to receive. So I really, there were healthcare providers that actually were not providing their data as required previously, and now we are getting the data because we have provided a secure electronic method for them to do so. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vasquez and then Talrico.
With regard to the required reportable items, on slide 5, you have immunizations. What type of immunizations are required to be reported in this system?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, the only part of the immunization data that is reported via the Health Information Exchange is actually that an immunization was given to a patient. It is not deal with any of the administrative aspect of the immunization system. That is all still handled within the VACTRAC, which is the immunization system with the Department of Health and Social Services. So it's really just a record that a healthcare provider provided, let's say, a flu shot to one of their patients, and just that patient got a flu shot, and so that way, ideally, the next time that patient is seen by a different healthcare provider, maybe they go to the emergency room for something, that emergency room would then know, hey, this person already got a flu shot, we don't need to give it to them again.
Okay, Representative Vasquez.
So this would cover all Medicaid patients that, for instance, would be given a flu shot.
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, the only patients that are within the Health Information Exchange are patients whose healthcare providers have connected to the Health Information Exchange, and those providers have discussed with their patients what the Health Information Exchange is, and that they as a provider are going to participate in the Health Information Exchange, and that at that time or at any future time, the patient has the option to opt out of the Health Information Exchange. There is no requirement under state or federal law that Medicaid patients must participate in the Health Information Exchange. So any and all Alaskans can choose to opt out of the Health Information Exchange.
Representative Vasquez, follow up.
Do you have a written form that explains the patient's rights and so forth that the patient would be required to sign before they enlist in this health information exchange?
Representative Vasquez, through the chair, Alaska eHealth Network is the nonprofit organization that manages the health information exchange, and they work directly with each of the provider organizations to, if the provider organization does not already have such a form, but it is left at the provider level for the healthcare providers to provide those forms. But Alaska eHealth Network will work with them individually if they don't have such a form to help the provider organization develop that form.
Representative Talrico.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Davidson, I appreciate your presentation. I'm just wondering if you have a set of notes or something you could share with us, the PowerPoint that we have. you certainly provided much more information than what we actually have in the documents in front of us. Could you send some of your report to the chair so that he could share it with us?
Yes, Representative Halko through the chair. Yes, I would be happy to supply the full slide presentation, including my notes.
Thank you.
And at the end of your presentation, you were talking about the controlled substances database, and we're going to be looking at SB 23 at our next meeting, and we'll be talking about that. My concern is that the controlled substances database, opioids, is not being effective. People are required to bulk load once a month, but there's no requirement that a provider consult that before issuing a prescription. Would, as you've looked at this, and it seems like this would be a much easier bus to be able to ride to get that database, all that information loaded to, as which is required under state law in the database, and also for people to consult with. So can you, if you can't do it now, can you send us an estimate of the time and cost of what it would take to convert the current database and where that's housed into this network so it would be a usable system? Because what we're wanting to do is to cut down on opioid addiction instead of just working on after people are addicted. We're wanting to prevent that addiction, and one of those methods is to make sure that prescriptions aren't being given because there's such a delay in that database.
To the chair, yes, I would be happy to research and provide the timeline and cost for connecting the prescription drug monitoring program solution to the health information exchange. We are very early on in the evaluation of that as an option, but I do believe that it would help providers in being able to reference the controlled substance, the prescription drug monitoring database better as part of their process in dealing with their patients. And so I do think that it could be a useful tool to have the connection with the health information exchange, because it would allow the provider to be able to pull back appropriate data and to query that data, the prescription drug monitoring data, back into their electronic health record solution, which would be better aligned with their day-to-day business operations. So I would be happy to research a rough timeline and cost for what it might take to make that connection, and I can provide that to you.
Great, thank you, and we'll look forward to that, and you might want to listen in on next Tuesday, because that's when we're hearing SB 23, and we'll be having this discussion of how we make the controlled substances database usable and effective to try to slow down the epidemic that we have in Alaska. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had some of the similar kind of security questions, and some of that's been resolved by your description of what is the mandatory reported information and sort of the difference from the provider level. But I'm just thinking, if I'm a patient and my provider has selected to participate in this exchange, and so, a lot of my pertinent information is all electronically, recorded electronically, what kind of backup measures do you have in the situation of, say, a major earthquake or some kind of incidents that would, potentially have several days with limited electricity? Is it possible in a crisis situation like that that there could be critical health information that isn't able to get between point A and B because, we've relied on all of it being electronic and we don't have a way, do we have a backup plan, essentially?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, yes. So the Health Information Exchange, the solution that we have here in Alaska, is a service as a software solution. And so it really is a web-based cloud solution. I mean, we will always run the chances of, not being able to connect to the internet to get that secure data, but it is more likely that we would eventually get rather rapidly get infrastructure set up for disaster and emergencies that would allow people to be able to use laptops and other technology in order to connect to the internet to get connected to the Health Information Exchange to be able to access patients' records in a disaster situation. There are also, typical of most information technology solution implementations, there are abilities, most data is captured, there's data centers that capture data, and so those can usually be accessed, if Alaska is in such dire straits, technology-wise, because of a disaster, we would be able to likely contact other people in the states through the Health Information Exchange vendor, Orion Health, to be able to find ways to be able to access our data so we can readily treat patients.
Thank you. I was just thinking, with the pretty substantial earthquake the other day, and then we've had the shipping issues, so a lot of stores are actually bare. It just reminds you that we're somewhat vulnerable in situations with our remote location. And have we had any security breaches, since the implementation? There's been a lot of high-profile security breaches of people's personal information. Have we had anything like that happen?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, no, we have not had a single security breach.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Thank you very much for the presentation. We'll look forward to that information on the controlled substances database. And also, when you send that, would you also outline what the connect, or what if there's a potential problem that we require controlled substances to be entered by the providers, or to be whether they would access the database before prescribing, does that automatically mean that all providers would have to join the network? And would that be on a individual basis, or would that just be on the, can it be segregated out as the controlled substances if they don't want to participate on the full panoply of reportable issues. So anyway, we'll appreciate getting that information, and we'll proceed along. So thank you again, and if there's nothing else before the committee today, we'll be adjourned at 4:55.